from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that.
White House officials are very tight-lipped about this story in The Washington Post that President Trump, during that meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, that he revealed classified, highly classified information.
What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation.
After the briefing was over, the president asked the vice president and the attorney general to leave the room. And then, according to Comey writing in this memo, the president said, quote, "I hope you can see your way to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go." He also told Comey that Flynn had not done anything wrong.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Boy, there's a lot of news in just the last couple days out of Washington. I will say that all of this is coming as President Trump gets ready for his first big international trip. And he's making a stop today in Connecticut. Coming up at 11 o'clock today, we'll have live coverage of President Trump's commencement speech at the Coast Guard Academy. That's on WNPR and WNPR.org. I will be joined by the same gentleman who joins me today, Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is our Democratic political analyst, Bill Curry. Welcome back, Bill. Good to see
morning,
you.
Morning, sir.
And Christine Stewart is here. She's editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello there, Christine.
Good morning, John.
I promise no cake. I promise no singing, but I will say happy birthday, Christine.
Thank you.
I hope you have a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day outside, and there's a little bit to talk about in the news today, right?
There is.
You picked a good day to have your birthday. We're going to spend the first half of today's show on what's been happening with the presidency, what we've learned from the Washington Post first earlier this week and then the New York Times just yesterday. The second half of our program, we'll be spending a lot of time on the various plans that Governor Malloy, Republicans and Democrats at the state capitol have been coming up with to fill an ever-growing budget hole. But first, from the Times yesterday, President Trump asked the FBI Director James Comey to shut down the federal investigation into Mr. Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn in an Oval Office meeting in February, according to a memo Mr. Comey wrote shortly after the meeting. As we heard in that soundbite, "I hope you can let this go," the president told Mr. Comey, according to this memo. Does this take things, Colin, even a step further than we were on Monday, where we believed that the president was leaking information to the Russians about a Middle East ally?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it takes us a little bit more than a little. I think this is more of an inflection point right here. Obviously, we have been inching along towards conversations that get us towards the big conversation about whether or not Donald Trump is a fit president to stay in office and whether there's the political will to get him out of office one way or another through impeachment or the 25th Amendment or whatever else. To me, this does feel like some kind of tipping point got reached. I just want to just take a moment to just mention how we get our news these days, too, which I think is part of the one of the reasons we feel this so viscerally. This is the second consecutive week where right around 5:30, 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night, this huge thing has happened. Now, last week it was the firing of James Comey. But so yesterday I happened to be going to a reception that had nothing to do with politics, but it was they were using the governor's mansion, which is in my neighborhood. I walked over, and the time it took me to walk from my house to the governor's mansion, when I arrived there, people do what they do these days. They take out their phones, and they show you their phones. Because the story of James Comey and the supposed paper trail slash memo had broken. And to me, it is a game changer. It's a game changer to whatever extent it's real and can be pinned down. And Jason Chaffetz is already saying he will, if it exists, he will subpoena it. I'll just quickly say that we could debate prior to this whether comparisons to Watergate were fully warranted. Boy, this is a lot like Watergate. This is a lot like the smoking gun. The smoking gun, if you recall, was a tape, not a memo, so it was a little less disputable when something's on tape.
But there may be a tape.
There may be a tape. It was a tape, and it was Nixon telling his chief of staff to tell the CIA to shut down the FBI investigation. So now you have a memo in which Donald Trump asks. Maybe the ask part, he asked nicely. Maybe that counts for something. But Donald Trump asks directly the FBI director to shut down an investigation. So, wow, it's the comparisons are a little keener right now than they were even 24 hours ago. So, yeah, I feel it's a tipping point kind of day. And I think as we talk this out a little bit more, we can talk about what, sort of game out how the next sequence of events could go, and I think there are multiple scenarios for that.
So my only problem, Colin, with the Watergate comparison is that it's very clear that we live, for a million reasons, in a very different age than we did then. Back then, we didn't have people taking out their phones and all immediately sharing information. We also, I think, had a little bit of a different sensibility about what we can expect of public officials for a number of reasons, not only having to do with Donald Trump. It feels like an inflection point for those of us who want to believe in good governance and who want to believe that people in Washington are doing the right thing. But I don't know that it feels like an inflection point in 2017 America, where so many things happen so rapidly and so differently than any of us grew up with. I mean, am I being naive in saying that?
No, you're being the opposite of naive. There's a new book. I'm now actually not going to be able to summon up the title of it, by a British journalist named Michael D'Ancona. And he talks about how one of the big differences between now and then is that algorithms have replaced editors. So an algorithm doesn't care about what's true. An algorithm is mainly concerned with what you like. What does John like to read? What does John like to read about? How can I give him more of that? And so algorithms, with each passing year, become more important. And the people who actually curate news and make decisions about what's important become less important. And so, yeah, that may be the big difference, that at a certain point in 1974, there was sort of a national consensus about what had to be the conversation, you know, and then there were a series of questions within that consensus. Did this happen, or what did the president know, and when did he know it?
That's right.
These questions, they became universal nationwide questions, and you could have different answers to it. You could have slightly different arguments about what the significance of the answers were, but there was no getting away from that central rubric. Whereas, yeah, now, you know, I mean, you know, Sean Hannity did a show last night that had nothing to do with any of this. And, you know, Fox was really worried. Fox News last night in primetime was really worried about the Clinton Foundation. Seems kind of crazy. But, yeah, you know, that's what their algorithms tell them. Their audience doesn't want to hear about this stuff.
Well, Trump's campaign sent out a fundraising email, and the subject line of the email was sabotage. That, you know, that there are people in the administration, in the unelected bureaucracy, that want to see his presidency.
All I can say is, boy, I'm glad the Fox News bill is picking up on some of these stories that the rest of us aren't following, because, boy, there seems to be other things going on in the world. We'll pick up on what...
It's a big help.
It's a big help. Let's pick up on what Colin's talking about here. Do you see this as an inflection point, a Watergate-esque inflection point, or are things entirely different because of all the other confounding circumstances that we find ourselves in today in politics?
No, I think if anything, the question, the only interesting historical question is actually, I think, more Andrew Johnson than either Bill Clinton or Richard Nixon. And then the question is that Andrew Johnson now has the world land speed record for how fast you got impeached. It just took him a year in office. And I think that's the question. Is your money still on Andrew Johnson or Donald Trump? And I do think this. There are other problems, though, that are like these that will inhibit this. And one of them is how delicate all of his critics remain. If you look at the threads of the last few years, whether or not the word narcissism is justified, whether or not the word fascist is justified, whether or not the word treason is justified, and today whether or not the phrase obstruction of justice is justified. And it just goes on and on. And Trump, on the other hand, isn't afraid to call people Nazis and crazy. And all the rhetoric from the right, and especially from Trump, is incredibly difficult. And on our side, if anything, I think we're a little too delicate. If you read the statutes, and there are a number of statutes on obstruction of justice, and there are words that are just like influence and impede. When people say they're not sure it's obstruction of justice, what they really mean is they're not sure that they can meet the evidentiary standard of criminal intent. They're wondering if you can bring the case to the jury. They're not really wondering whether he was obstructing investigation. And one, it doesn't matter. You know, if you're obstructing justice, your defense can't be, well, I thought he was a good guy. That's absolutely irrelevant. And if after you said, please don't prosecute him, you then fired the prosecutor, a jury won't, you know, I wouldn't hesitate to bring that to a jury. And so I think the most important things we can begin to do now is press people. I noticed I posted something on Facebook, and for the first time, I didn't have a bunch of Trump trolls jumping in to defend him and attack me just yesterday. The White House aides are in their offices.
I haven't posted yet.
The White House offices are in the White House aides are in their offices are in the bushes. The congressmen are canceling their meetings. We have to flush out from the other side. What do you think constitutes treason? What do you think constitutes obstruction of justice? At what point will you be willing to admit this? and admit the things that have happened here, both in substantive crimes and in cover-up. And if I could just add one other thing, and that is that there's this great debate over the Democrats are pushing over a special counsel, independent counsel, select commission, and I'd like any one of all of those things. But the main thing to get right now is a commitment to what those things do. Subpoenas, sworn testimony in public forums, and a commitment to let both parties have a control of the witness list.
I'm feeling as though that's the question.
Yeah. None of those things are happening right now. And if you remember the famous phrase from a hearing, you know, "Sir, at long last, have you no decency?" Joseph Welch, the great figure of the Watergate hearing, Sam Dash. Because congressmen and senators want FaceTime, they no longer hire professional lawyers like Bobby Kennedy with the mafia, Dash, Joseph Welch. We don't have those kinds of hearings. We stopped having them within the last two decades simply because the politicians want the FaceTime. And the hearings as they have them aren't adequate to the task of prosecution or of eliminating these facts. So the kind of hearing, if they're going to stonewall on a special prosecutor, making sure that real professionally staffed hearings with subpoenas in open forums with mutual control of the witness list, at least make this a professional job.
I think people are going to start lawyering up because I think the questions are going to start, you know, flying. You know, what did you know? When did you know it? When were you told? And so I think that's probably going to be the next step.
And it then remains to be seen how many people who are either advisors to the president, people who have shifted their careers to go into the White House, or people who are in some way involved in partisan politics on the Republican side, how far they're willing to go with this president. Whether or not there's any potential legal implications for them is one thing, but there's an awful lot, Christine, of political implications for a whole ton of people in Washington where they put some faith in this president and said, here's our opportunity to govern for a couple of years, and it looks like it might just be a couple of years.
Well, and I think that you see the frequency of the leaks that are coming from inside the White House from these unelected bureaucrats who are concerned or worried about what they're seeing, and that's why we're seeing the leaks to the media.
And that really is where the investigation should be, you know, more about the leaks. Anyway, please, Colin, continue.
Somebody said the other day that they should just put the flower pot with a flag in it right outside the West Wing, you know, because or maybe like 10 of them. So, you know, if I were a New Yorker cartoonist, I'd have like 10 guys in trench coats in the same garage kind of jockeying for space to talk to different reporters. I mean, the leaks are tremendous here. I think one of the questions over the next few days is who gets to create reality. One of the things that Donald Trump has been very good at is creating reality and kind of saying, I create reality. I decide what's true. I decide what's real. If I decide something's true on Tuesday and something completely its opposite is true on Wednesday, that's what I'll do. And for the most part, this has
worked. Everyone knows that.
You know, yeah. And I think for the most part, this has worked pretty well for him. And the only way it's not going to work well for him is if somebody else kind of a group of people collectively seize control of the reality-making machinery. But, you know, in the short interval, I mean, I think he's got an odd little needle that he has to thread. On the one hand, I mean, when you get into the kind of mess that he's in right now, the way that you get out of it is by shoring up as much power as you – the more powerful you are, the harder it is to take you down. Impeachment is still basically a political process. High crimes and misdemeanors are essentially still whatever Congress decides they are. You know, they may have some legal definition at the level of precedent, but much more important is, you know, what does Congress decide? So if you're very powerful, it's harder to take you out. So he needs to continue talking to the base that he has. So they want to hear some of this heated, heightened rhetoric that they're very used to hearing from him. He also has to appear, quote, presidential, unquote, to some less persuaded people who need to see somebody acting the way they think presidents act as opposed to the way they think madmen act. So he's kind of got to do both of those in the days ahead before he leaves on Friday. I can't imagine what this world tour will be like, but it may be the best thing that could happen to him getting off our shores for a while. But he needs to control reality in order to win, because if anybody else controls reality, he loses, because reality really militates against him heavily right now.
There's reports of his staff are very concerned about leaving him in the room with world leaders, mm-hmm. and he's about to embark on...
Or a cell phone.
Right, or a yeah. cell phone, or anything that yeah. you can tweet with.
Sharp objects.
You know, get the guy a straitjacket. You know, it should be interesting to see, I guess, what do we expect him to say today at the commencement ceremony. Do we have any expectations? Or
well, it's interesting. We've been trying to figure out what those expectations are, Bill, but the problem is that things have moved so quickly over the course of the last couple of days. I can't imagine that he won't in some way address it, because he seems compelled to address every single thing that happens in the world that has anything to do with him and gives him bad headlines. I don't know. What do you expect him to say at the commencement speech today?
You know, because I feel that I'm living this life to pay penance for something I did in a past life I can't remember, I read his last commencement speech to Liberty University a couple of days ago, and it's appalling. I mean, it's just appalling for its emptiness, for its vacuity. He actually read off a list of the football teams that the university is going to be playing next year, a president giving a commencement speech, so I have no idea. And when this guy came into office, I mean, literally, when he won that election, it wasn't just Democrats who were shocked. The entire Washington establishment in both parties woke up and felt like the staff at an asylum learning that the guy who thought he was Napoleon had just been appointed Emperor of France. You know, they couldn't believe that this guy was actually going to hold but any high public
everyone
office.
Everyone is so shocked, but Republicans in Washington and around the country right now have, as Colin said before, largely lined up behind him. You'd said that, you know, the criticism coming from both parties has been very gentle, a little less gentle within the last 24 hours, certainly. But for all that shock and amazement at him being elected, it seems as though people still haven't backed away from a president that seems to be radioactive right now.
When Nixon resigned, 25% of the country thought he was still doing a decent enough job and shouldn't be forced out of office. When Bill Clinton was under pressure from Democrats, Dick Gephardt and Joe Lieberman, as well as the Republicans, on impeachment, it was only when polls consistently showed the country opposing impeachment by 2-1 margins that they began to back off. One of the things that you guys have been raising, you and Colin and Christine all, how much have we changed? Will it be 22% despite the seeming mental incompetence and fraud and potential treason and obstruction of justice? If all these charges prove out true, what percentage of the population will still support him, and how much will that mean? And I think it's going to go down low enough. But I do agree with this. Unless, you know, that in checks and balances, the final check and balance is the public itself. And unless the public moves, impeachment doesn't move.
I want to get to Peter in Stanford real quick. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yes, I think Bill Curry sort of stole a little bit of my thunder. I do remember in the books, Winstead Bookstore, Community Bookstore, when it was like a fait accompli that this guy could not win at a dog catcher. And the media was totally wrong. The polls were totally wrong. Is this guy, Trump, the Teflon president like Reagan? Or is he an imperial president where it's nothing? You know, he said he was going to go on Fifth Avenue and shoot, kill somebody, and his supporters would still support him.
He said he could.
Is the media a victim of
Actually,
their
I think he
own,
said he had.
Right, yeah. I think the verb's really important there.
Yeah, well, but no, Peter, you raise a really good point, which I want to put to Colin here. I mean, he's essentially saying something that a lot of us think. I mean, I don't know. Nothing has seemed to stick to him so far. Maybe the 22% approval rating that Bill says might be some sort of a threshold. Maybe it doesn't matter in America right now. Maybe it's different.
Right. So, first of all, I think Peter's got a very valid point, a very valid question. And, you know, Bill quoted Joseph P. Welch. I'm going to quote Omar from The Wire, who famously said, "If you come at the king, you best not miss." And this is an interesting inflection point that way, too. In other words, if you don't, in fact, have the horses to do this right now, if you're going to come at Donald Trump this early in his presidency, take a full-fledged shot at him at removal, and you know, if you don't, in fact, succeed, he'll come out of that stronger, and it'll be harder next time. In other words, you could be 18 months from now looking at even more egregious conduct and have less of a chance of impeaching. So, yeah, I mean, first of all, yes, as Peter says, he's defied predictions in every possible way. He's defied logic, precedent, institutional lessons. They've all just sort of flown out the window. And the window is the Overton window, which is also completely out of shape right now. And that's the thing that measures what you can say and what you can't say. So, yeah, I mean, you know, why should anybody pay any attention to anything we say? But my best guess is that, yes, they certainly have a very powerful argument to make. But if they don't make it with the right horses, they're going to leave him stronger than he was a week ago.
Emily emails us and says, "Long time no hear or see. Conway, Bannon, Ivanka, Kushner, Spicer, who's moved aside for McMaster. We've been hearing, Bill, about a shakeup inside the White House, in part due to the inability of people to follow what the president's message even is and then be able to get that message out there. Are we going to see a whole series of people getting canned so that the president can continue to do what he does, maybe deflect some attention away from the president himself?
One thing he's going to find is that as he fires people, they're going to be harder to they're going to be as hard to replace as they should have been to appoint. It's finally reaching an inflection point, I think, at which more conservatives and Republicans will see what being connected to him in any way, shape, manner, or form does to their own lives and their own careers. While these people, I'll say one thing, as I said earlier, they're all hiding in their offices or the bushes, and they've canceled their town hall meetings, and they're not posting on Facebook. And part of it's because they're afraid, but also, I think, to give them credit. If I woke up one day after the 2008 election and found that Barack Obama was mentally incompetent or might have committed some serious crimes, it would take me a while to adjust myself to that idea. And I think part of what's happening right now is just the silence of people incorporating this. And I don't the one thing I've insisted throughout this to all my friends, don't mistake the American people for Trump. If we give up on the good-heartedness and open-mindedness of the electorate as a whole, if we take these decisions they've made in fear and anger and begin to believe that they've been so infantilized that they can no longer conduct themselves as citizens, we're done.
Do you have a quick thought, Christine?
No, I was just going to say that the New York Times has a great piece on this today on page 16, that
oh, yes.
The aides cope with chaos and
yes.
Boss's
yeah.
foul mood.
Yeah.
They are experiencing, he is taking it out on them.
Can I just say
that was
say,
actually about yeah. the Kane
yeah.
mutiny.
And anybody in Washington right now who has an agenda, and an important agenda, a policy agenda, people in the business world who thought they could get certain things done under this particular administration as opposed to the last one, is also very frustrated right now because nothing is going to happen for a very long time until this stuff gets sorted out, which is one of the things that creates an incentive to sort this thing out.
Yeah, one of the things I'm looking at with the New England News Collaborative is this big list of infrastructure projects that have been pitched to the Trump administration, trillions of dollars all over the country, different states with different big ticket goals. And they probably thought these things were going to get done. Maybe they're not going to get done. Quickly, Christine, before we break, Governor Malloy's going to be there today at the Coast Guard. And this is interesting. We hear that Senators Blumenthal and Murphy won't be making the trip. Senator Blumenthal probably as visible as any senator in Washington this past week, calling for a special prosecutor. He got taunted just before he came on our air last week by President Trump. They're not going to be there. Joe Courtney, who represents that district, says he will not be there. But the governor is going to go hang out with the president today.
The governor was just reappointed to the Council of Governors by Trump. So, I mean, he's watched his words carefully last week before because he knew he was going to be seeing Trump on Wednesday. He's being political, I guess.
He's watching his words, which is...
I'm betting that no one in either party planning on running for office in 2018 is there either.
Yeah.
All the gubernatorial...
Right,
That's true.
Malloy's not running, what does he have to lose?
The single two people from whom everyone who regards himself or herself as still having an active political future want to avoid a public contact with will be both there on the podium.
Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more when we come back. We also want to get to what Governor Malloy is doing in his day job as he tries to solve a big budget hole with Democrats and Republicans. Coming up at 11 o'clock today, WNPR and WNPR.org will have live coverage of President Trump's commencement speech from the Coast Guard Academy. We'll have guests. We'll also take your calls then. We're taking your calls now at 860-275-7266 as we talk about a busy week in the news here in the Wheelhouse. This is the Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com. Also with our political analyst, Bill Curry, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. As we've been saying, I'm going to be on with Colin for maybe a couple hours talking about and around President Trump's commencement speech at the Coast Guard Academy today. It starts at 11 o'clock. But then you've got a show today at 1 o'clock, Colin. What's your show today?
That's a very good question. So, yeah, we've had to sort of juggle some things around. So right after we finish this show, I'm going to be recording a conversation with Brooke Gladstone from On the Media about a book that she's got out right now, which really explores the moment we're in terms of its philosophical contours in particular. So our ability to judge reality. So I think what we've decided is that that'll be a nice thing to put on the air at 1 o'clock when you and I are done. That will be the 1 o'clock show, unless something changes in the next 30 minutes, in which case it'll be different.
And Lord knows something could change the last 30 minutes. We're going to turn to the state budget in just a moment. Maybe Colin, some closing thoughts here as we move on. We've been talking a little bit about the politics around this. I mean, we've got Democrats who certainly believe that a Trump presidency, even a shortened Trump presidency, might make for a better opportunity for them to make inroads in Congress in a couple of years. What does it mean for Republicans, and how long do they stick with this unpopular and seemingly spiraling president? What does it mean politically?
I think, you know, St. Augustine said, make me pure, but not yet. And in some ways, I think the Democrats may feel that about the White House right now, that obviously they would like to see Donald Trump out. A lot of people would like to see Donald Trump out. But at the moment, like if he were to resign, say, during his Coast Guard speech today, that wouldn't necessarily be good news. The 2018 elections would no longer be about who would be running the country. That would be Mike Pence. And I think his political profile would take longer to digest and process and understand who he is. So it's a little bit harder to stage a political revolt under those circumstances. Whereas if, in fact, Trump continues to dysfunction. He seems to be a satellite in a decaying orbit, and nothing can be done given the current political constitution of Washington. Then you have a 2018 election that's essentially about that. Are we going to keep this guy, or are we going to change the composition of Congress enough so that we can get rid of him if we need to? And so in a way, as I say, having him hang around a bit is maybe a better scenario, at least for some Democrats.
Bill?
You know, if there was ever something to be nonpartisan about, I've always been skeptical of the idea of bipartisanship. We always do things like deficit spending in the Iraq War, and I don't know why it has such a good reputation. But if there were ever a moment for it, this would be it. And also because people who think in partisan terms in these in moments like these almost inevitably outfox themselves. I was talking to a good friend, Anthony Brooks, a political reporter for WBUR in Boston, and he said to me, "Well, don't Democrats?" He said, "Don't Democrats worry that once they've gotten rid of Trump, they might get Pence, and that would actually be harder?" And I said that I'm just, you know, I want to get rid of the guy who might blow me up. And Anthony responded that he wasn't really worried about Trump blowing him up. And I said I wasn't worried about Trump blowing Anthony up, or I mean, the rest of you guys are all collateral damage. I'm worried about him blowing me up. If you think someone's as bad as I've just said he is, you get rid of him. What you might get out of it, by the way, between a Pence, this is a Democratic Party that has been merely reactive and defensive and critical. It still hasn't had the debate the losing party was supposed to have after the election. Tom Perez, the DNC chair, and Bernie Sanders have been on a unity tour.
That is absolutely right.
But you can't have unity without agreement, and you can't have agreement without a debate. And this party is if one of the things about getting rid of Trump may be that we go back to something more like a normal substantive political debate in which the Democrats actually have to answer how they'd fix Obamacare, how they would do these things. And Pence, as a traditional conservative, a more restrained, mature, and self-contained version of Trump, we might actually, in addition to getting rid of the risk of everything Trump might do wrong, the politics of the country might get a little better.
Yeah, everything I hear about that unity tour, by the way, was going really great.
Oh, yeah,
that
was going really great.
It was going
great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You know, they really liked each other.
Tell us something you agree on.
Well, I have to say, and we're gonna turn a little bit to state policy in a moment. Christine, it's sort of interesting, state politics, too. I mean, look, it's not just the Congress people in Washington who have been sort of yoked up to what happened with this Trump wave and this unlikely presidency. I mean, there's going to be an election for an entirely new legislature in a couple of years as well. And that entirely new legislature, some of them kind of threw some support behind Donald Trump. Some of them are distancing themselves quite a bit. I mean, this sort of stuff trickles down throughout the Republican and the Democratic Party.
Oh, it definitely does. And I think that we've seen actually recently people who were inspired to action by the election of Donald Trump have started to organize in a way that they hadn't organized before. We have a group that came out of it called Action Together Connecticut, and they've actually been going around the state trying to get involved locally and at the state level, talking about the state budget and state budget solutions that they would want to see. So I think that, you know, they're going to stay involved.
The point that Bill just made about Mike Pence potentially being a more of a problem for Democrats, I just wanted to give kudos to Jeff, our caller, who had to leave us, who wanted to ask us about that very thing. Well, okay, we got plenty of time to talk about Donald Trump coming to Connecticut today. Again, 11 o'clock coverage. And if we turn back to that, perhaps we will. But there's a lot happening at the state capitol as well. Christine Stewart covers it as well as anybody. I'm reading on ctnewsjunkie.com a story that you posted just the other day about the Democratic legislative proposal. I'm just going to read the lead sentence here. It says, legislative Democratic leaders put forward a budget proposal Tuesday that legalizes marijuana, expands casino gaming, creates a paid family and medical leave system, and reduces funding for Connecticut's clean elections system. So to me, that kind of looks like we're going to grab some money, we're going to grab some more money, we're going to spend some money, and then we're going to sweep some money. So it's the grab, spend, and sweep plan.
Yeah, it's great. It's completely unrealistic.
You make it sound so appealing, John.
I get so many emails about that, but please go continue. Yes.
It's completely unrealistic, I think. The Democratic proposal, spends way more money than Malloy's revised proposal.
$300 million
in like the first year. And, so legalizing marijuana, they estimate, would bring in $60 million in revenue in 2018 and $100 million in revenue in 2019.
And I just want to stop you because that's one thing we want to talk a little bit about. Where do they get those numbers from? I mean, we sort of beat up a lot of people around the fictitious numbers around Keno whenever it was proposed a couple of years ago. $30 million this year, we don't know. Where do they get $60 or $100 million from?
It's completely made up. I mean, let's just be honest. it's kind of this pie in the sky. You know, they say that it's based loosely on the Colorado and Massachusetts model, but nobody really knows. You know, they're only estimating that it would cost $1 million to set up a system where we sell marijuana to people.
That's the number they put on there.
That's the number that they put on there. we're only going to spend $1 million, but we're going to get $60 million in revenue. Yeah. So it's really...
How soon?
Well, but before we go through some of the other plans, let's just stick with that for a second, Colin, because, I mean, we've talked about this in the show. We have a certain number of callers who call us up every single time we talk about the state budget and say, legalize it and tax it, and we'll make all sorts of money. The question is, will we make $60, $100 million? Do we even know how much money we might make at this? And is this the right way to make this kind of policy?
Yeah, first of all, last night at the governor's mansion, the governor was there, but there wasn't really time to ask him about this. However, Connecticut's greatest economic mind, Danny Haar, was also there. And he feels as though that the marijuana revenue estimates are very, very high. You should pardon the expression. But shame on them. Shame on them anyway. This is the drunk uncle budget, right? This drunk uncle comes home and he raids everything and he smashes the kids' piggy bank so he can get back to the track. You know, I mean, this has everything in it that drunk uncle likes, and none of, next day sober uncle's sense of shame and propriety. But just to stay with marijuana for a second, you don't legalize marijuana to balance your budget. You legalize marijuana because you have decided, based on some scintilla of rational reflection, that it's a good idea to legalize marijuana. You don't do it strictly as a revenue source, and you don't just jam it into your budget without it's actually being considered independently as a policy question.
Oh, but so, we did it with Keno. Why not marijuana?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't have done it with
Keno. Christine raises a fine point.
the answer is they should not have done it with Keno. And the marijuana thing is a much more pervasive thing. It's going to change a lot of things in this state. I'm not saying it'll change things for the worse, but they don't know that. They haven't made any attempt to know that. And they should. It's the most disgusting part of this fairly disgusting budget proposal. I would say one more thing, which is one thing I did notice about Dan Malloy last night was he seemed like he was in kind of a good mood. And I think you're in a good mood if you're the only person who's put out a budget that, even as cruel as it was on several levels, but it had policy in it, it had choices in it. And it's the only budget proposal so far that's had any of those things and made even a little bit of mathematical sense to boot.
Well, and we'll get to Malloy's budget plan and maybe whether or not the Republicans have their own budget plan. Quickly, you want to talk about pot bill?
Well, I just wanted to say that, yes, first of all, that's sure. But I look at this, more drugs, more gambling.
It wasn't an offer, really.
More drugs, more gambling, more corruption. It's like the state's turning into Potterville, And, I mean, we're just really, if you take a look at just look around you and see what their answers are. And I oppose, as you may recall, in my two races for governor, I oppose legalization. And I've always been very wary about it. And I think just, you know, there's enough data in now and enough is happening. I think it ought to go forward, not this way. Not this way.
Right. And I think there's an agreement on that. I just want to say that there is no agreement among the caucuses. I mean, if they put this up for a vote today, you know, even as a standalone marijuana legalization bill, it would not pass.
Mm. And by the way, Bill, to make good on Colin's earlier reference, the town we're actually resembling right now, it's called Hamsterdam. That's another wire reference. So here's the deal, Christine. So we've got this Democratic budget, which is sort of what it looks like, and we've gone through that a little bit, and we expected some of this in there. It spends more money than Governor Malloy's budget. Colin just talked about a budget that the governor has put out that it maybe is cruel in places, but has some policy. I mean, what's the governor saying we need to do here to fill this hole?
The governor has put forth, he's saying, you know, look, there's going to have to be some pain among the municipalities, but I'm going to try to cap that pain by capping the portion of the teacher's pension fund that they have to cover at $400 million. You know, as far as revenue is concerned, you know, he's looking at raising the real estate conveyance tax on homes that are valued over $800,000, which really, you know, isn't going to have a huge impact. And then he would eliminate the sales tax exemption on non-prescription drugs like Tylenol and Aleve.
You know, which we all needed to wake up morning with.
You know, I would just say, first of all, to tweak that a little bit, it doesn't eliminate their pain; it just postpones it. That's not a real reform. What they're doing, and what these municipalities are being left with, we've seen this in states as close as New Jersey, where Chris Christie did exactly what Malloy proposes: get all your savings out of cuts to municipalities where the services are delivered that people care about most: fire, police, schools, and they, of course, then have to raise the property tax, the most regressive tax. The person in the middle ends up with a much heavier tax burden, mm-hmm. and that's really the Democratic plan right now, that at least at the top.
That's the only way to get revenue. The most people are in the middle, it's going to hit the middle the hardest.
Let me just say, it's not the only way to get revenue, but that's a longer discussion. And the second thing is, you have to get savings. And one of the problems here, we have the same thing at the state we have at the federal level, which is Democrats unable to construct an argument, their own vision, their own blueprint. In this case, because Malloy is the second worst governor of my lifetime, and he has left this state a public policy disaster area. And among the problems is the first time Chicken Little is finally right, the sky is falling. And what the things you have to do include real pension reforms. There has to be some capping. There has to be some looking at some of the abuses that have occurred. And no Democrat wants to say that out loud. No Democrat wants to push to get the insurance industry out of the healthcare business in this state for the state government to get a real a public option, as I proposed many years ago, which is the only thing that can drive costs down. We're not dealing with corruption, which drives costs far more than people realize. So, in fact, there's no real plan on the spending side. We've postponed all these problems, and you now have the state at the greatest fiscal and economic crisis I think it's faced in my lifetime, and there's nobody and there's no one willing to put a plan on the table.
Colin?
I think that second thing is the real problem, though. In other words, I agree that there are many things. I never said Malloy's budget was a nice budget, but it's kind of the only budget. And I don't even know, Christine, if you would call what you got yesterday a budget, as you pointed out in your article. I mean, this is like some kid who didn't do his book report and the last minute scratches some stuff on paper and just jams it at the teacher. This is a one-page Excel sheet.
It's like, it is, yeah. You know, no, that's exactly what it was. Yeah.
I mean, it was a one-page Excel.
It was a one-page Excel
sheet.
Oh, wow.
That is so brazen. That is just a kid.
I mean, we can go back and forth about what kind of governor Dan Malloy is. But he's sort of the best Democrat in Connecticut right now by default, because there are no good Democrats, because these people have not been able to introduce any meaningful set of policies to counteract his. So anything you don't like about Dan Malloy, I think, could be completely legitimate. But absent any kind of other voice from the Democratic Party, they are a bunch of chickens. You know, they won't talk about anything that they think is the least bit unpalatable to anybody. And so at the end, they give Christine and Paz and everybody else one page Excel sheet. read.
I'm just going to ask you, Colin, to amend what you just said quickly before Bill gets very angry. He's the best Democrat currently serving in some sort of public public office, right? You didn't mean to overlook Mr. Curry.
No, I mean he's the best Democrat up there right now. He's the best Democrat who's part of that process right now.
It's that tallest dwarf thing, you know, where and by the way, that if you're the guy who caused all these problems and the proposal you're proposing doesn't actually fix them, you can only be the best by a very small margin.
But you can't, I mean, you can't, for example, scream at the Republicans in Washington because they won't do anything about Trump and not scream at the Democrats.
The Democrats won't put a blueprint on the table, but this is the wrong blueprint. And for the previous 6 years, none of these problems were addressed. And that's why we are where we are right now. We've never been between such a rock and a hard place.
I do have one little tweak I'm going to suggest, and we'll go to break, which is I got it from John Ridley back in his days when he was doing comedy. Here's my proposal. You legalize marijuana, but people have to get it in person from the Department of Motor Vehicles. I think that would slow down the abuse.
Art Buchwald once said you can have as much money as you want in Congress without having to vote for it, but you have to come out down yourself and count it out in small bills.
We're gonna take a break. When we come back, do the Republicans actually have a plan to solve this? And we'll also get into one of the weirder spats we've ever seen in the Bonding Commission. I mean, we never really get anything fun from that commission, but we did have a little bit of a back and forth between a leading Republican and Governor Malloy. We'll talk about some of those things when we come back in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with our own Colin McEnroe, with our political analyst Bill Curry and Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. A reminder that at 11 o'clock, we'll have live coverage of President Trump's speech at the Coast Guard Academy today. I'll be there with Colin McEnroe. We won't actually be there. We'll be watching from here, but we'll have a cast of people who are reporting in for us from the Coast Guard Academy in New London. We've gone through Governor Malloy's budget proposal, Christine, gone through what the Democrats put out in a one-page Excel sheet yesterday. What are the Republicans doing? We've been asking for some details from them. They were reticent to give out any kind of details on their budget. Did they actually give us any details?
They did give us some details, but they gave us two sets of details. So the House Republicans came out with their own budget proposal and the Senate Republicans came out with their own budget proposal, and both of them are different. But the what they share in common is that they asked for more in labor savings for the most part. So they expect, you know, now that this deficit is larger, they expect the governor should be able to get more from labor, and they make some suggestions as to how that should happen.
And the governor is already asking for and expecting big labor concessions, but they're just ramping that up a little bit, up over a couple billion dollars.
Right. And I think what people are forgetting about this whole labor situation, I did a piece on Monday, the leadership of CBAC has to vote to open the contract for health and pension benefits. Then that has to go out to the rank and file union members to cast their vote. So this has to be something that's saleable to a large number of people. And so it can't just be all the state getting everything at once.
Yeah. And it will take a while to actually happen as well, which is one of the
things.
Last time,
I think it was over a month it took to happen. The voting happened over a period of a month.
Right. So that's kind of magical thinking by the Republicans. Not only that, but there are certain, I don't know how specific they got. I haven't seen it. But, there's certain things that you're not going to get, right? You're not going to change tier one pensions. Most of those are, already being enjoyed by people in retirement. Right. There's sort of things that
they were asking to bring into alignment with the private sector, public sector pay for the current employees who are making less and contributing more than the tier one employees.
Go ahead, Colin.
I think as they head into the next electoral season, as we sort of were suggesting earlier, they've got a bunch of problems too. Themis Claridis, the leader of the Republicans in the House, additionally has the problem that she probably is more heavily identified with Donald Trump right now than any Republican I can think of. She went to the rallies and she was up there making some noise about him. But they will also have the problem if they haven't really introduced anything meaningful. Maybe they can sort of slide through the electoral process with a certain number of platitudes. They can say basically, well, we asked for more labor savings. Whether or not those were specific proposals with a lot of practicality attached to them or not, that might be lost on the average voter. So I don't know. I don't know how much pressure there really is on them other than moral pressure right now to come up with a realistic counterproposal.
I just
a political point about all this, and that is that on the Democratic side, they don't see the degree to which honesty and substance are their only way out, and the degree to which they have to distinguish themselves from Malloy. You know, I know Nancy Wyman's thinking about running for governor. Very nice person. It'd be kind of like Bonnie Parker having to say, you know, Clyde Barrow. I think I did a ride share with him once. You know, anybody connected to Malloy in this state, and that includes not just the people at the top, but every single legislator who didn't speak up. They have just the rest of this session, just a few more weeks, because once they're in reelection territory, it's going to be too late. They have a very short time to stand up to the public and say, we know we're on the wrong road and we want to change. And because of what we've done, all that we postponed, they're going to have to get honest with their base as a part of this discussion.
I want to play something that actually happened at the Capitol this past week. We read a story in the Connecticut Mirror about it. Sort of a weird thing that happened at the Bond Commission, which, of course, Governor Malloy sits on. And it has to do with Republicans who don't want to bond anymore at the state level. Probably we can't because of all that we owe already. But anyway, here's Malloy and two Republican legislators who sit on the commission, Senator Scott Frantz of Greenwich and Chris Davis of Ellington. They sparred over the necessity of all this borrowing. Here's Frantz after abstaining from a vote on some borrowing.
My policy is not to waste time by voting no and getting into discussions about whatever.
We've had this discussion.
We can only
vote no by voting no. We can't assume you're voting no. Particularly when we call, when I say it passes with no opposition. So if you want to go on record as voting no, you need to vote no. That's how government works.
I understand that. The clerk knows that I'm a no on pretty much everything.
There's an audience of people here who deserve to hear your vote on every item. And what the clerk knows and what you think you've made the clerk aware of, you know, that's not how we vote.
I understand what you're saying, but anybody who's been here more than once or even just once understands my attitude towards borrowing and certainly borrowing too much.
Again, are you voting for or against the item? Because you have voted routinely to approve minutes that indicate items have passed unanimously. And you say that the clerk knows something. So I just want to point this out, that if you want to vote on an item, you have to vote.
Okay, well, I'd like to stick with my policy. The clerk knows I vote no on everything.
So at this point, has thrown up his hands and is shaking his head like, you know, I have no idea what he is talking about.
The poor clerk.
He's not being recorded as a no. You know, it's just not. It isn't in the record as a no for all these bond commission meetings.
I just want to say that we were off break, and when John had said we had a really, really fun story on the bond commission, and I told him that was impossible. And I was wrong.
Pretty good, right?
I was wrong. That was pretty amazing.
That's actually a pretty good piece of tape.
Yeah. On a semi-serious note, this is one of the reasons you don't want the legislature to have more control over CTN. Because, first of all, things like this are really fun. You know? But also, this is probably the kind of thing that Scott Frantz, once he realizes what a pusillanimous little spineless piece of junk he comes off as, would probably rather not have as part of a televised record. Well, I mean, Malloy's absolutely right. Just vote no. Stop doing this little thing about what everybody knows.
And what he consistently says, what Scott Frantz consistently says, is that his policy is not to waste time by voting no.
Yeah.
I love the way his voice just trailed off at each response. You know, and so there it's kind of, then you just couldn't quite make out the final few words.
Right? Not to waste time by voting no. Well, here, Christine, as we said at the beginning of the show, it's your birthday today. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
I hope you have a very nice day covering things at the state capitol, which
yes.
is fun. But you've got a plan. I mean, I think we should give you the floor here for the last minute or so of the show because we were going in front of the Bond Commission. You've got a plan to really solve all of our problems at the state level. What's the plan?
I do. So Connecticut has to bond for a DeLorean. We have to go back in time. We have to fund the pensions so that we then don't have all this extra money that we've spent on
you
things.
You mean Marty McFly's DeLorean?
DeLorean.
Yes.
Marty McFly's DeLorean.
Not just a regular DeLorean.
Sure.
Keep going.
And then we won't have that problem. But we could also bet on some, you know, the World Series a few times.
Bet on the Red Sox
and
a couple years ago.
Put some money, and we'll have a rainy day fund by then. So, you know.
I like this. What do you think, Colin? Well,
first of all, somebody get me Ron Mallett on the phone right now. And we actually have a UConn professor who's been studying time travel. You will not be able to buy your DeLorean from a DeLorean dealership in Connecticut because we don't allow that. See, the fact there's you have to buy it used from Shaler.
There's always a hitch. It's a great plan. Happy birthday, Christine Stewart.
Thank you.
From CTNewsJunkie.com. Read it because it gives you all the information you need. Bill Curry, Democratic political analyst, our own Colin
Thank
McEnroe,
you.
Who I'm talking with at 11 o'clock as we break down what's happening at the Coast Guard Academy as President Trump addresses the cadets there. Thanks for joining us today in the wheelhouse.